This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning, this is Pacific Beats on ABC Radio Australia. Today on the show, more than half of Papua New Guinea's population thought to be living in poverty, with tens of thousands displaced by violence.
I think some of the long-standing problems that we continue to see in PNG is really the weak enforcement of laws on violence against women and children, and really a culture of impunity where perpetrators think they can get away with abuses.
Also today, we look at new research into the communication methods of dolphins and how they're affected by human noise pollution. And we'll also catch up with a country and Western star out of the Pacific who's bringing his unique blend of musical genres to the Tamworth stage this week. All that and more coming up on the program. I'm Nick Fogarty. It's great to have your company. Well, Papua New Guinea is at the centre of a new human rights report which reveals close to half the country's population is living in poverty. The Human Rights Watch World Report 2023 sheds light on a litany of human rights crises that unfolded in 2022 in 100 countries across the world. In PNG, the report estimates violence alone has displaced 89,000 people in the country's highlands since May, and violence against women and children remains an ongoing issue. Human Rights Watch Asian Director Elaine Pearson breaks down the report with Kyle Evans.
Papua New Guinea is a very resource-rich country, and yet it's somewhat surprising that 40% of the population still live in poverty. And this is really as a result of economic mismanagement and corruption over many years. And I think the COVID-19 pandemic, you know, really highlighted some of the challenges that the PNG government faces there, particularly with the severely under-resourced healthcare system. I think some of the long-standing problems that we continue to see in PNG is really the weak enforcement of laws on violence against women and children, and really a culture of impunity where perpetrators think they can get away with abuses.
Yeah, you mentioned a ton of issues there. And one of the interesting things, like you said, very much a resource-rich country, does have a lot of things going for it. But at the same time, in terms of those other issues, things seem to be going backwards. Is that fair to say?
Well, I mean, I think PNG has long-standing significant problems that simply haven't been addressed. So, you know, I think we don't see many bright spots where things have improved. I think the one thing that was positive last year was that the parliament voted to repeal the death penalty 30 years after it was reintroduced. But elsewhere, you know, 2022 was not a good year. I mean, in terms of the election, we documented violence, delays, electoral irregularities, and, you know, some of these were very severe. I mean, we saw people killed. We saw thousands of people have to flee their homes due to election-related violence. And we still know that, you know, some election candidates, you know, that are being investigated for instigating that violence, we're still on the run. So, you know, in September, I believe the UN estimated that about 90,000 people were displaced by violence in Papua New Guinea's highlands since May, which is really a very high number.
So we saw a crackdown on a number of laws throughout 2020 to try and stop a lot of these issues that you mentioned or try and mitigate them. It doesn't seem like it's getting through at the moment. Are the laws not going far enough, or is it an implementation issue?
It's really an implementation issue. I mean, you know, we have seen progress with the parliament passing laws. So, for instance, last year in February, new legislation was introduced to really strengthen the criminal penalties for sorcery-related violence, which continues. And, you know, we have seen hundreds of people killed due to sorcery-related accusations where people are accused of sorcery, and then mobs, you know, in some cases have, you know, tortured, assaulted, particularly women. And, you know, there is absolutely no accountability for these abuses. So they get a lot of reporting in the media. In a few handful of cases, perpetrators are sometimes arrested. But actually ensuring that there are convictions for these killings is what will send a strong message that there is accountability. And until that happens, I think we will continue to see high numbers, unacceptably high numbers, of people dying as a result of sorcery-related accusations each year.
I know one of the issues that's prevented PNG from being able to stop or mitigate these issues is funding of police as well. Is that something that they've got to put sort of more of an emphasis on?
Yes. I mean, I think the police in PNG are chronically underfunded. You know, they are understaffed. They lack very basic resources to go and investigate crimes, whether it's stationery to write down, you know, police reports, whether it's petrol in the car to go and investigate crimes in remote areas. They are facing a lot of issues that prevent them from addressing the outbreaks of violence that have occurred, particularly the outbreaks of violence that we saw in the national election. That said, police in PNG also have a long record of violence themselves with impunity, including against children. And so I think it's not just a funding issue. It's about ensuring there is accountability within the police force and ensuring that there's better monitoring and benchmarks in place to ensure that police, you know, that are provided funding are adequately doing their jobs. And so this means documenting the crimes that are occur, the number of crimes, but also the arrests of perpetrators, the investigations, and how many are actually convicted of the crimes that they are charged with.
Yes, we've definitely established that help is needed. Just in terms of that help, what kind of things can governments like Australia do to actually try and help the PNG government get on top of these sorts of things?
Well, I think it is a positive step that, you know, the Australian government last week, you know, has announced more support, particularly to police in terms of law and order. But I think that support needs to come with very clear human rights benchmarks. And so we want to see progress on these issues. We want to see better documentation of just how many people are actually reporting these crimes to police and what actually happens in terms of investigation and prosecution of those cases. So, you know, I think that's where the support needs to come, because, you know, you don't want to just be providing support to an unaccountable police force. And we know in many cases, these crimes are underreported because women in particular have very little faith in the police. I mean, I remember myself interviewing domestic violence victims who said that police laughed at them when they turned up injured at the police station in order to report their husbands for very serious incidents of domestic violence. So I think the Australian government has a lot to share there with the PNG government, because, you know, Australia also has grappled with, you know, unacceptably high incidence of domestic violence, but obviously, you know, has a system in place now where victims are coming forward in order to report those crimes.
It sounds like if they can get that data in place, you can really put an action plan in place after that.
I mean, that's the idea. I think, you know, at the moment, the UN is the only institution that's really sort of tracking the number of these cases. And they have documented, you know, I think it was 388 cases in 1 year in four provinces alone of deaths and torture as a result of sorcery-related violence.
That was Human Rights Watch Asian Director Elaine Pearson, and she was speaking to reporter Kyle Evans. Now, you might think this is a familiar scenario. You're in a noisy pub or another place, and you have to raise your voice when you're talking to your friends or family so they can hear you. New research shows dolphins may face the same issue. They have to shout to each other when they communicate or cooperate in response to loud human voices or noises from shipping or drilling. Lead researcher and PhD candidate at the University of Bristol in the United Kingdom, Danish-born Pernille Sorensen, told Dubrovka Volodor it shows the impact that noise pollution has on marine animals.
They definitely do react to noise, and they also find ways to compensate for it. So what we show here in our study is that the dolphins are able to compensate for to some extent, or at least they show the vocal ability to compensate by adjusting their vocal behavior. However, what we also saw in this study was that despite the fact that they can do that, that's not enough for them to be just as successful as they were when there's no noise present.
And tell us a bit about this study. So you played them some noise. Let's listen to some of that noise. So what did the dolphins do when you played that noise to them?
Yes, so when we played back some of our noise to the dolphins, they would respond by adjusting their vocal behavior and their physical behavior. So on the vocal side, they would increase the volume of their calls, so calling louder, and they would also increase the duration of their calls.
Yes, let's listen quickly to how their whistle sounds without noise interruption. And let's now compare to how they sound when there is noise interruption. So we can hear quite a clear difference, can't we?
And yes, and then we also saw that the dolphins changed their physical behaviour, so that with increasing noise, we saw that the dolphins would orient towards each other more. And they would also swim towards the other end of the lagoon where the other dolphins was, maybe to kind of make sure that the other dolphins were there before they went back and attempted to press the button.
Mm-hmm. And so this button that you mentioned, the task of them was to work as a team. Can you just tell us a bit about that setup? Because it's quite interesting.
Yes. Yeah. So this setup was, we conducted this experiment at the Dolphin Research Center in Florida in collaboration with our colleagues there. And this cooperative setup is a setup that's been used in some previous studies as well by my co-authors, where they wanted to investigate how whether dolphins understand the role that a partner plays in a cooperative task. So that was the original kind of setup. And then we took this study and adapted it to investigate how noise impacts cooperative behavior. So what happens in this task is that the two dolphins that are participating are asked to swim towards two underwater push buttons that are placed on either end of a sea pen. And then they're asked to press this button within 1 second of each other in order to be successful and get a reward. And at the same time that they're doing that, we equip them with this sound and movement recording tag called a DTAC that records all the sounds that the dolphins are emitting and using to communicate with each other to coordinate the task. And we also have a speaker in the water that plays back these different noise levels that we're exposing them to.
And so it really shows us that dolphins really react to the noise around them. That includes shipping, that includes drilling, all this human noise. Do you think there's been an increase in that sort of noise? And what sort of effect does that have on populations of dolphins and, you know, possibly also other animals that live in the sea?
It definitely shows that this noise impacts them. And despite the fact that they're trying to compensate, they are still less successful at performing this task. And I think, you know, in the last couple of decades, we've seen an increase in the amount of noise pollution that we have in our oceans, because we as a population of humans have also expanded our, you know, we are more present everywhere than we've ever been. And that also is true for the oceans, so where we see that we are using the oceans much more for shipping traffic, drilling, etc., that has an impact on animals. And what this study really shows is that we really need to account for how noise impacts animals working together, because they might not be as successful coordinating behavior when they're exposed to noise.
And I think your study also shows that even if dolphins change their behavior, so they shout to each other so that they can, you know, communicate better and easier, and they face each other, they often aren't as successful because of that level of noise. So it does have quite a severe impact.
Yes, exactly. And that's a really good point. You know, these two dolphins that are participating in this task, they are highly motivated. They know exactly what they're doing in this task, and that they know that their partner is in it to try and succeed. Whereas animals in the wild might not know when they have a partner that is initiating a cooperative behavior. So we can imagine that maybe wild animals will be missing opportunities for cooperative acts because they don't hear each other. And that can have impacts not only, you know, on the individual's health, but if it affects many individuals over a longer duration of time, potentially on a population scale too.
And what sort of impact does this study have?
So this study is one of the first to kind of, or to our knowledge, the first one to show that animals working together are impacted by noise and are less successful at performing a cooperative act. And what's really important to remember is that cooperation is widespread across the animal kingdom. So animals working together and using sound to communicate that behavior might all be impacted in a similar way. So this really highlights that not only do we need to account for how noise impacts dolphins, but this could be a more widespread thing where we need to account for and manage noise pollution better to reduce the impact it might have on group living animals.
Is there anything we can do, or do you think it's too late?
No, so the really good thing about noise pollution is that we are creating it. We are creating this noise, and we can stop it if we want to, so it can go away again. And that's really useful for when you want to manage noise pollution. So what we can do is that we can start trying to find solution on how we can better manage noise pollution and potentially, you know, try and reduce it in areas that are really important for animals working together or performing really important behaviors. And yeah, so we can try and do something like that in order to reduce our impact.
PhD candidate Pernille Sorensen speaking to Dubravka Volador there.
Pacific Beat.
The United States is close to signing deals with two Pacific nations, Palau and Marshall Islands, as China becomes increasingly assertive in the region. The US has signed memorandums of understanding with the two nations that could pave the way for broader deals that would govern their ties for the next two decades. These compacts of free association grant the US unique military and other security rights on the islands in return for substantial aid. Joining us now from Canberra is Dr. Graham Smith from the ANU's Department of Pacific Affairs. Good morning to you, Dr. Smith.
Good morning.
Can you tell us about the significance of this memorandum and what it could mean for the new Compact of Free Association agreements with Marshall Islands and Palau?
Yeah, so it means it's mostly across the line. This is something they've been negotiating for a long time, and ultimately it will be a 20-year deal. So it's, you know, taking the US forward, you know, into a basically into the 2040s. So it's a hugely significant deal, partly because the Marshall Islands last year suspended negotiations with the US because they weren't doing enough to recognise the impacts of nuclear testing on the health of the Marshallese. So yeah, I think the US will be quite happy. They've got these two agreements across the line. Of course, there's still one more to be negotiated with Micronesia. So yeah, I think they'll be looking to have them all wrapped up by the end of the year.
So what are the benefits in this for Palau and the Marshalls?
Yeah, so as you said, they're compact states, which means people who are resident there can access US Social Security. A lot of them, a large number of them, join the US military. So in effect, you know, it's a huge boost to their economies. And it's a massive turnaround. I mean, as recently as 2008, the US was talking about an exit strategy and how these countries need to become self-sufficient. And now we have a completely flip situation where they're going to be signing on to much more generous agreements than they've signed on to in the past.
You mentioned, obviously, this situation's kind of been flipped in the last few years. And how much of this kind of flip and the proposed increase in funding is thanks to the influence of China in the region in the last few years? And how much is simply recognition for past wrongs, such as that damage caused by the US with nuclear testing?
Yeah, I think most of it is about China. And I think as part of that process, it's forced them to listen to Pacific voices and realise just how horrific the legacy of nuclear testing has been in these countries, as well as unexploded ordnance, which is a huge problem, not just in these states, but in Solomon Islands and elsewhere. But absolutely, it's China that's brought them to the table and completely changed their outlook on these agreements. And it's not, I mean, these aren't the only countries involved. There's a whole bunch of other countries that never get to come to the negotiating table. Guam, the Northern Marianas are all part of, you know, sort of special military access that the US enjoys in the Northern Pacific. But they don't get these chances to renegotiate their status, unfortunately.
Why is that?
Because they're a different status. They're non-governing states. And it's legacies of colonialism. So these are, you know, sort of territories that were acquired a long, long time ago. So it's a real continuum. If you look at Guam, poor old Guam, they have a missile they developed in China called the Guam Killer. And, you know, a third of their landmass is occupied by US military bases. So they watch geopolitical developments just as keenly as anyone else, but ironically don't get to sit at the table in the same way.
So you mentioned, obviously, you know, people from Palau and the Marshalls, you know, they gain these benefits of being able to potentially live in the US, join the US military, you know, large financial outlay in their countries. On the other side of the coin, what are the benefits for the US there?
Absolutely unfettered military access. That's the name of the game. And these compact states occupy a huge sea area. And in the case of the Marshall Islands, are home to a vast military base, which is, you know, the home to nuclear missiles. So in a strategic sense, you know, it beggars belief looking back that the US was thinking of pulling back, because, you know, this in many ways, much as China is challenging them, this is in some ways their trump card of containing China. Without these agreements, they're in a real difficult situation, because China, of course, is looking to up its military presence in the region.
You're listening to Pacific Beats, and I'm speaking with Dr. Graham Smith from the ANU's Department of Pacific Affairs. Dr. Smith, you also mentioned the US is in talks with Federated States of Micronesia. How's the situation different there? There's something to do with a separatist movement, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, FSM is a very interesting case. Of late, they've certainly been fighting the US's corner, most notably when there was that attempt by China to sign a regional agreement on security and economic matters. It was the president of FSM who actually came forward, Mr. Pranuello, and wrote a letter to Sogavare basically saying, you know, get on board and pull your head in if you like. But they are the one compact state that recognises China. Palau and Marshalls both recognise Taiwan, which makes them different. And there has been this ongoing, if you like, issue in Chuuk, which is looking in some ways to form its own state. That's the largest island in terms of population in FSM. And they have a very distinct identity and distinct language and culture. And you know, there has been a little bit of heartburn thinking, you know, if they become a separate independent nation, they might want to, you know, have their own agreement or even leave the agreement. So that puts them in a slightly different category. But this is a football that keeps getting kicked down the road, if you like.
And I believe there are also, you know, potential organised crime links to China that are an issue in Palau. How important is that point likely to be for the US?
Yeah, this is a really interesting development. There was this great report that came out about a month ago, and Palau is the wealthiest of the Pacific nations. Its GDP is pretty healthy, and it isn't a country that recognises China, but ironically, because of that, it means the Chinese state turns a blind eye, or one could even argue actively encourages elements of Chinese organised crime to destabilise the country. And there have been some extremely unsavory characters. A guy called Broken Tooth, which doesn't sort of augur very well, has been active there and trying to set up casinos, being involved in sort of online scam operations that largely target China, to be honest. These sorts of things are quite destabilizing for a small country like Palau. So yeah, even if the Chinese state isn't there, elements of the PRC are still having an impact in Palau.
And China and Taiwan have been in a seemingly never-ending arm wrestle over the loyalties of Pacific Island nations in the last few years. Would this development with the signing of the memorandum, would that be encouraging to Taiwan?
Oh, absolutely. They you know, this is again a sign of how much things have changed. I mean, back in 2008, Taiwan was seen as the destabilising element in the Pacific, and you know, we're regularly being admonished, not just by the US but by our government for their checkbook diplomacy and generally upsetting the apple cart in the Pacific. Now, however, Taiwan is lumped in as a like-minded partner, and they would be extremely pleased to see these negotiations go the way that they've gone. And it means it's likely they can continue to hang on to two of their allies in the region.
Well, we'll be watching closely to see what happens there in the next few years. Thanks very much for joining us, Dr. Smith.
Thank you.
Dr. Graham Smith from the ANU's Department of Pacific Affairs.
Hold the front page!
Time for the latest news headlines now from around the Pacific region, and I'm joined by our reporter Kyle Evans. Good morning, Kyle.
Good morning, Nick. Another day.
Certainly is, and a very hot one here in Melbourne. A Samoan sailor has been hailed as a hero after a daring rescue on Saturday. So what's happened there?
Yeah, so authorities are praising our Samoan Sakaria for Awiaso, who was among those who helped rescue 24 refugees off the coast of Florida. So this is reported by the Samoan Observer, who actually chatted with Sakaria, who shared his experience with the newspaper. It's understood he was working on a cruise ship, which was actually heading back to port when they spotted the refugees. refugees on an overloaded boat at around midday on Saturday. He was then selected to be part of a rescue team who braved some choppy waters to save the people with a lifeboat.
And what was the condition of the refugees?
Yeah, not too great. They'd been without water, food and shelter for 7 days, so they were literally just hanging on by a thread. A lot of them elderly as well. However, they all escaped safely and they are currently all alive and well and successfully boarded the cruise ship.
It's good to hear. And staying on the water, a maritime team is investigating a sunken vessel in Solomon Islands. Why is that?
Yeah, so the Solomon Islands Maritime Administration has sent out a team to assess a wreckage of a former passenger/cargo vessel that sank off a reef near Western Province yesterday. So this is reported by the SIBC, who say it wasn't an active vessel. It had been stuck on a reef for several months after it ran aground back in 2021 before finally sinking. And there had actually been no attempt to salvage it until yesterday. But it looks like it's only happening now, as it appears to be a bit of an environmental threat. So nearby residents have said there's an oil spill at the site, and apparently there is a strong odour of fume and oil and diesel as well.
Has anyone claimed responsibility for that?
No. So according to the article, the owner of the ship has so far been unresponsive. And obviously, as we know, it's not the first sort of oil spill in the area in recent months. It also follows that discovery of oil from what was believed to be a World War II ship, a World War II naval ship that was sunk, you know, back in the 40s, which sort of popped up late last year.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And lastly, a push is underway which could allow American Samoan residents to vote. Is that right?
Yeah, this is a really interesting one, I thought. So two American Samoan senators are actually sponsoring a bill to allow permanent residents to vote. So it's just a proposal at the moment, and it would only be for permanent residents who have lived in American Samoa for 30 years and have paid taxes for 20 years. They must have an ID as well. However, if it gets up, that would then allow them to vote in American elections.
When will that proposal be heard?
Yeah, so senators are set to hold a public hearing in the coming days to get input from the community, including those impacted by the legislation. So, yeah, like all these things, there'll be plenty of red tape and a huge process involved. But, who knows? It might just get up.
These things do take a while, and be interesting to see what happens there. Thanks very much for joining us, Kyle.
Thanks, Nick.
Kyle Evans with the latest news headlines from around the Pacific.
You're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia.
It is Tuesday, January 17, and you're listening to Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia. We're already up to week 3 of the new year, and I hope you've all settled in nicely. Still to come on today's show, we'll hear from people in central and northern Queensland who are bracing for more torrential rain. And then we'll check in with a Samoan country music artist who's in Australia performing at the nation's biggest country music festival.
Love sport? Tune in to Can You Be More Pacific with Sarah Nangama and Dean Halatau.
But, like, you know, rugby union, like, they reset the scrum so often. Like,
here we go.
It's a bit of a time waster. Like, we just get ours done and move on.
Yeah, but see, like, your play is, like, no different to just a tap and go.
Don't even try and compare it. Let's stop trying to one-up each other.
Yeah, we're going to end up in a fight soon.
Can You Be More Pacific? Fridays from 2 p.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia.
People in central and northern Queensland are bracing for more torrential rain as rivers continue to rise, cutting roads and stranding locals and holidaymakers. An emergency flood alert has been issued for some residents of the Mackay CBD and the suburb of Cremorne. Elsewhere, the deluge is filling dams, but it's also putting sugarcane crops at risk, which is worrying farmers who've already had a challenging season. Annie Guest reports.
Rainfall has broken two-day records around Proserpine, a lush area named after a goddess of agriculture. Sugarcane farmer Joe Morano says the region is awash.
Very disappointing for those growers that still got cane left in the field. They would have invested in their crop in the year before, hoping to get that cane off. Disheartening. It's like, yeah, you're expecting an income, you tried to pay your bills, and you don't have it.
Mr. Morano, who's also the regional chairman of the Peak Group Cane Growers, says Queensland producers will lose a lot of money, but not because of rain alone.
I'd say $150 million. Yeah, you know, it's a combination of things why this cane's still there. It's the wet weather, the La Nina, Its mill performance across a lot of areas hasn't been up to scratch, and, you know, shortage of workers.
Producers of other crops who are yet to plant are glad dams are filling, but hope precious topsoil isn't washed away by the deluge. Meanwhile, floodwaters cut roads around Claremont and other mining and rural communities and stranded highway travellers in places like Mick Dodson's Prince of Wales Hotel in Proserpine.
It's been fully booked out for the last couple of days. We've had a few young fellas. They've been here for about 3 days since Saturday, so they'll probably be here for at least another day or so because you cannot get to the airport at the moment. So we've had a few other fellas too that have been up here working and they can't get back.
Have you had many people ringing who you can't accommodate? I hear that...
Of course, no. It's been running hot for the last 2 days. Every place in Proserpine is booked out at the moment.
In Proserpine and further north in Bowen, people and pets have stayed in evacuation centres. Also, locals have reportedly offered shelter in their homes.
Probably it's getting up to nearly like Debbie, when Cyclone Debbie was here. Yeah, that's about the last time we've had water like this.
The road closures have also stalled trucks, forcing drivers to shelter in their cabins by the roadside. And off the coast, the Whitsunday Islands have also been drenched. The Weather Bureau has forecast up to 500 millimetres of rain could fall in some parts in 24 hours.
Annie Guest reporting. Samoan artist Mr. Cowboy is in Australia this week, performing at the nation's biggest country music festival, where thousands of Australians have flocked for great country tunes. And he joins me now. Good morning.
Hello, Nick. Good morning.
How have you found performing again at the festival after having 2 years on hold?
It's so good to be back, eh, Nick? It's great to be back and reconnect with our friends and all the people that my friends in town with.
So what's the atmosphere there at the festival like?
Oh, it's magical. It's like home away from home, you know, and it's just magical, you know. It's just a different vibe from, you know, back home. You know, you don't see this every day back home. And being here in town with is just beautiful and just loving it here. It's just beautiful.
Country music from Samoa is not a phrase that you hear often. So what led you down the path of becoming a country music artist?
Country music has always been popular in the island, especially in Samoa. But we've just done it in our own language. So what I'm doing now is trying to sing more English songs, but it's such, yeah.
So I guess what led you to choose the stage name Mr. Cowboy then?
So I've been singing on televisions, I've been singing on radios back in the island and performing on some shows back in the island. And people kept asking, where can I find, because they didn't know my name and what type of genre that I was into. They keep calling me, where can I find the cowboy, the cowboy that sings that type of song, that type of music? And when I heard that, that became a name that, you know, called myself Mr. Cowboy. So, yeah.
And during the 2 years of global shutdowns, it was a tough time for everyone, but especially for singers and artists. So How did COVID-19 impact on you personally and on your career?
It's hard. It was really hard, to be honest. It's hard not being able to get back on tour again, but it was good at the same time. I could spend more time with my family and also especially my dad and work on the farm and selling taros and spend more time with family as well. So, yeah.
And being at Tamworth now, I was looking at the program and, it's a huge program, famous music festival, and, you know, dozens or hundreds of artists performing. So who are some of the artists or musicians there that you really look up to and that you've been happy to meet and listen to this week?
Adam Harvey, you know, and I love him, you know, all his songs, all his music. It's just an inspiration as well, listening to his music, and such a great guy.
And now that you're back performing and releasing music, what's next for you after Tamworth?
I'm just going to keep on shining, you know, just what I represent, my people, my country, our culture as well, and also our Pacifica people. Becoming the best and trying to push myself to the limit.
And some of your YouTube clips of a couple of your songs, and one of them we're going to play in a minute, they've got hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of views on YouTube. What do your family and friends think back in Samoa when they see this level of attention that you're getting?
Oh, they're just so proud of me. And my family and friends have been so good to me. And they were so keep on pushing me towards my music. And they're just so proud people, to be honest. And it just gave me that push, you know, that what I'm doing is right. And it's just... It's just great, you know. It's proud of me and what I'm doing right now.
Fantastic. And as they should be, very proud. I believe you had a show last night, and I think you might have a couple more today. So we'll let you go and prepare for them and rest up before those shows. But thanks very much for joining us on Pacific Beat. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Tune in to SBS Samoan News on ABC Radio Australia. SBS Samoan News features independent news and stories connecting you to life in Australia and Samoan-speaking Australians by our friends at SBS Australia. SBS Samoan News. Tune in Mondays and Thursdays at 6:05 a.m. Samoan time for 1 hour of news in Samoan language on ABC Radio Australia.
New research looking at Fa'a Samoa of New Zealand-born Samoans living in Brisbane has found their traditional culture to be beneficial to life in Australia. Leah Fa'aluli'i, Dr. Dion Enari, recently graduated with his PhD on the topic and celebrated with the Samoans who came before him as PhD graduates. He spoke with our reporter Jordan Fennell about the emotional toll completing the PhD had on him as he peeled back the layers of culture in his community.
It's a big sign of relief. Like, I felt like I had the whole world on my shoulders whilst doing it, you know, and just having the worries of the PhD hanging over my head for the past couple of years, it's nice to finally put this beast to rest.
So your research looked at the perceptions of Fa'a Samoa by New Zealand-born Samoans in Australia. What went into, I guess, collecting the data needed for you to investigate and look at these perceptions?
Just peeling it back a bit. The PhD was birthed out of a big gap and concern that I saw living here in Australia and seeing how a lot of my teachers and just the general mainstream society didn't really know us, and they would impose a lot of negative stereotypes on us and on our culture. So me being a Samoan, I knew straight away that I wanted to change that narrative, because I knew it was wrong. And I knew the most powerful way to change it would have been via the highest degree that you could obtain, which was a PhD. When I went collecting, that was really the fuel of the fire that ignited me to really do this PhD. When I went to the data collection phase, it was a lot of talanoa, a lot of speaking with other New Zealand-born Samoans in Australia, and then going to a lot of different events where New Zealand-born Samoans would congregate and seeing their behavioural patterns. And out of the whole phase of the PhD, this was probably one of the most confronting phases because I got to hear firsthand many of their experiences with the Samoan culture, and I got to see as well with my own eyes how that played out.
Because it was something that you had experienced yourself, you know, going through schooling and hearing how people speak about, I guess, the Samoan community in Brisbane, what sort of, I guess, either toll or, I guess, emotional labour did you have to do to be a part of something like this?
The toll was enormous. The toll was also enormous because I come from this community, there is massive pressure for me to tell the story right and for me to give honour, to privilege and to centre the lived experiences of my participants in a noble manner. Because I know if I don't do this properly, there'll be an onslaught of researchers that don't come from this community that will continue to negatively write and impose their own biases on my community. The pressure was huge.
So, going to some of the main findings that came out of your research, a lot of it obviously centres on the different generations of Samoans that pass through from Samoa to New Zealand and then Australia, and I guess how identity can either be lost and then reformed once here in Australia. What did you find was the most significant finding from the research that you did?
So my research, you know, proves what a lot of my community have always known, but we can put this one in the academy, that a Samoan who is more grounded in their culture and their language and knowing their different cultural protocols is more likely to have more positive well-being experiences than someone who does. And when I got to explore that deeper within my PhD, it was very interesting to see how a lot of my participants, a lot of Samoan people in Australia, used a lot of the different cultural knowledge that they had gained and then have implemented it in a Western setting. So then they've gone in. So an example of that is quite a lot of my participants who were strong orators in the Samoan culture then used their oratory skills in terms of being heads of board meetings in their Australian job. So the different cross-cultural happenings that occur, and then also looking at a lot of my participants who were bilingual speakers who could both speak English and Samoan, reporting how by knowing two languages it was easier for them to acquire their third language, so it was easier for them to learn French or to learn Spanish because they already understood how bilingualism went. The most fascinating message I got out of my PhD is our culture is not a barrier, but a carrier to success in the Western world.
Yeah, that's really fascinating. And I wanted to ask about how, I guess, that ties in with your own work. You said earlier that to explore this topic, you felt like you had to do it at this highest sort of academic level, doing a PhD. I'm just wondering how that falls into, like, the framework of living in Australia, which is a Western country with Western ideas, and I guess a PhD is a Western idea as well. What was that juxtaposition like, wanting to do this research through a Western lens almost, but bringing that Samoan perspective to it as well?
That's what made the job quite difficult but fulfilling. In terms of my research, had I added to the deficit ways that the academy looks at us, the PhD would have been done a lot faster, but because I challenged a lot of the norm of what the West perceives as reality and truth, it made my PhD a lot longer. This has occurred from the context that we live in. So because we live in Australia in an English-speaking Western society, for Indigenous voices to be heard at a high policy level, they need to be framed within a PhD or something of PhD level. for it to be taken seriously.
I saw on Twitter that when you were celebrating your PhD being completed, you had community around you, and you also honoured the Pacifica women who had helped you along the way. Can you tell me a little bit about why you chose to celebrate in that particular way?
So when we're looking at the differences between Pacific and Western people in academia, for the West, it's, you know, I, Jacob Samuels, got that PhD, and I, Jacob Samuels, strived and worked hard, and I got it, and that's why it's only my name on paper. As where for us Pacific people, it's never just about us. It never has and it never will be. It's a big village effort. At my graduation ceremony, I made sure to sit all the Pacific doctors that helped me along the way that live in Brisbane, because it was really only through their insight and their guidance that I was able to cross the line and get my PhD in a way that forthrightly served my community. It was a very emotional time because they were the older sister to me that they didn't have. So many of them were the first in their field to gain the PhD, and they fought the hard fight. And so because they did that, it made my journey a lot easier.
What is your message, I guess, for the people who come after you now?
Yeah, we have a responsibility and we have a job to do as Samoan and Pacific people. And if you have the capacity and the ability to do a PhD, then you should be doing a PhD. There are nowhere near enough of us in this space. This is a very big and a very real fight, and it is a numbers game. Every Pacific person that gets their PhD, it's another victory for our people.
That was Lia Fa'oli'i, Dr. Dion Inari, speaking to reporter Jordan Fennell. And that brings us to the end of Pacific Beat. We'll be back at the same time tomorrow. That's at 6 a.m. PNG time. I'm Nick Fogarty. Thanks for your company.